Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We are still on the hunt for the next thing that we're going to be chatting about, because we have decided that we potentially are going to bring an end to our weird laws from around the world. We've done that all of this year. I didn't realize there were that many weird laws are out there. But while we find something, and while we find something that we'll keep going for at least the next year, hopefully, you're tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the midterm budget policy statement and some expectations around that. That statement will, of course, be tabled tomorrow by National Treasury, and we will be doing our usual budget coverage in the evening on the show, taking a look at what it is that was said in the afternoon tomorrow. But we're going to get some expectations today ahead of that as to what we hopefully should expect or what we'd like to see come out of that statement. We also have a conversation with The Economist at Momentum Investments, taking a look at the unemployment figures. Unemployment rate falling to 31.9% from 33.2%. We're going to take a look at that and see if we can make sense of that and what it means for the South African economy. Then we have a conversation taking a look at the latest financing from the World Bank towards South Africa to the tune of $925 million, or around 16 odd billion rand. We're going to take a look at what those funds are earmarked for, and perhaps whether or not we'll get some clarity around that from National Treasury tomorrow. And then we have our agricultural conversations, as we do. We have Agri Tuesdays. We're going to be taking a look at the exports in the citrus industry over the second quarter of the year. We're going to speak to the chief economist at AgBiz, Wandile Sihlobo, around that. But we're also going to do a double bill of Agri conversations and take a look at Agri Tech with the team at Nedbank.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick things off, as we always do, with a sense of how markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by wealth advisor at PSG Wealth Route 21, Nielis Brink, to take a look at the latest market movements and see what we make of them. Nielis, always lovely catching up. Thanks so much for taking the time. The Rand on stronger footing. 17 Rand 16 is a figure we saw, I believe, only once last month. We are somehow back at that level ahead of a crucial mini budget that will be tabled tomorrow. The Rand and starting off the week in very strong territory. What do you make of it?
Jimmy, good to be back. It feels like I'm living in a dream. We've got the JSE above 110, Rand moving towards 17, jobless or the unemployed figure dropping by more than a percentage point unexpectedly, strong earnings from a couple of our top companies who's not selling gold, if I might add. It's absolutely amazing to see the movement. And then, of course, we've got a big expectation for tomorrow's budget speech to finally move closer to pin that inflation regime closer to 3%, which over the medium term for South Africa would, of course, mean a lower interest rate and a stronger currency. It's all very positive news. And that just a couple of weeks after we got off the grey list. And we see a couple of international banks considering re-rating South Africa or increasing our investment grade after tomorrow's budget speech.
See, Nielis, now that you put it that way, now you've made me nervous. Now I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop, and I feel like I have some form of PTSD. It has been a time where we've been struggling to kind of make heads or tails of some of the economic data. But to the credit of South African markets, we have got one of the best performing equity markets for the year. Certainly the best performing emerging market that we've seen throughout the year. It has really been an astounding year. And I almost feel strange saying this, but can we partly credit that to the instability that has been caused by President Trump in the US and how that has affected global markets?
I think the wake-up call that Trump has given a lot of countries around the world, that the US won't be simply there to your beck and call, the US won't simply be pumping money into your emerging market, your country, your deal, your healthcare, whatever you want to call it, And we're going to slap some tariffs on top of that. Whether that's right or wrong is another political discussion, which we don't have time for right now. But the effect that it has on a country like ours is to wake us up and to make sure that we start get going locally. I think the GNU is also playing a role here, that it's staying together and it's definitely working towards something that we haven't seen in more than a decade. And most importantly, I think the average South African company is adding value to their local market. And what I mean by that is we've obviously had a couple of massive performance in the gold space, right? But if you're selling gold at 4,100 an ounce, you're going to be making money. But I'm talking about strong earnings coming from, if we just take today as an example, from people like Santam, people like Premier, people like Richmond, people like Barloworld issuing trading statements, that strong numbers, right? That means that the average South African company is healing and growing. That means we're doing something right. And that's maybe why the Rand's reflecting that as well.
Niels, you touched on Premier and other companies giving us numbers today. I don't know if you had the chance to catch up on some of the numbers. Give us a sense of perhaps what some of the standout figures were that you noted today.
So two of the big companies that I saw today that excites me a lot, because I can't be another wealth advisor talking about gold on your program, is specifically the Premier Group results of this morning. So their stock is up 4.4% for the day, right? But I mean, they've increased revenue by 6.5% while increasing EBIT by 13.6%. So that's a normal, healthy company increasing revenue and increasing the earnings that they've derived from that without anything special happening. And they obviously, as far as I know, unless they pivoted, as far as they know, they don't sell gold, right? So that's the kind of picture we want to see. If we see proper earnings coming through from these industrial companies and the consumer staples, that means the economy is moving in a direction that we like. I can't credit this back to the unemployment figure just yet, because I'm always kind of skeptical about that figure. Is it because we've improved data, or is it because we're truly employing more individuals? Because there's always been a bit of skepticism around that number. But I mean, a decrease from 33 to 31, I just love that.
I certainly think we did need that number from a positivity and a sentiment perspective. I think markets and the South African economy is not happy seeing unemployment levels anything above 30%. And it is nice to see that we are perhaps and hopefully doing something about those figures. One will have to see how that filters into the economy at a later stage, though. Niels, I want to take a look at the oil price at the moment, $64.84 a barrel, seemingly on stable footing there. All the tensions around the Russian oil supply seemingly calming down there. Not much to be concerned about at this stage there, but we are still kind of teetering around that $65 a fine ounce level. I suppose from an OPEC bloc perspective, anything lower than $60 is highly undesirable, and $65 seems to be somewhat acceptable at this stage.
Absolutely. If we look at the last OPEC meeting, a slight increase in production. That means that they're not completely scared. The levels below 70 usually tells us that we see a calmer geopolitical space. So that means definitely that the war in Palestine, and then of course the war in Ukraine, is cooling to some extent. There's a slower demand for oil. And then more importantly, on a local footing, a big drop like was it 51 cents last week on the petrol price just before we head into the festive season. That's a big number for the average South African consumer. If we couple that with a positive rand and then a positive economic outlook, that's just a bunch of good news to take into the festive season.
Speaking of that festive season, Niels, before I let you go, are you looking forward to any particular markets or any particular movements heading into the festive break? It typically does become a shorter time frame, and we've only got, I'd imagine, maybe 2.5-3 weeks left of the year for real price movements. Is there anything you're keeping an eye on at the moment?
So two things. On a positive note, it seems like we're lining up with a bunch of good economic data, which might give us our very beloved but haven't seen in a while, as we call it, a Santa Claus rally, where we get that last little push before we close the year out at the end of December. If we can add another couple of percentage points to this beautiful JSE year, that could end us up well past 32-33% for 12 months, which is an absolute lovely figure. Something I'm a little concerned about, we've got one of our favorite holidays coming up at the end of the month, Black Friday, and I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek. We are concerned about the amount of credit card spending on discretionary items. It's a figure that's been picking up in South Africa. We're sitting with high or relatively high interest rates, so obviously your credit card rates are sitting at silly numbers. I hope the South African consumer can apply a good deal of responsibility in the next couple of weeks to not give away a lot of the growth that we've been given from the market in the last year.
The markets have been having a stellar year, and hopefully we can close off the year in the same fashion. We'll have to see how that continues to unfold. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the wealth advisor at PSG Wealth Route 21, Niels Brink, for joining us to take a look at markets and what seems to be driving them.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The World Bank has approved a $925 million loan, around 16 billion rand, for South Africa to support a six-year program that is aimed at reconstructing and developing South African cities. National Treasury is said to be using this money to reward the cities that show real performance improvements and accountability and institutional reforms. We're going to be taking a look at this with independent analyst and founder of Karuska Consulting, Kaya Sotole. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Kaya, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. It seems every time you and I catch up, there are new loans being processed and new finances being awarded. Can we make sense of this latest loan?
Good evening, and good evening to the listeners. So the loan seems to be one of those programs that these multilateral institutions tend to put together that is incentive-based. And what that simply means is that it is a loan that says if you do well, you will get access to more resources to do better. So the problem statement is that left their own devices, these cities, and I suspect a lot of South Africa's sub-national government structures, either do not generate enough income autonomously or do not have a strong enough economic and a consumer base for them to be able to do all the things that they need to do. That's the first problem, the lack of resources. There is then the simple question of, well, even if resources were not an issue, how do you get those that are tasked with running the cities to do the best that they can with what little that they do have? And an incentive program seems to be able to provide that positive stimulus that says that, look, we know that you wish you could do more. However, if you can demonstrate how well you can do with what little you have, you will have access to much more that you can utilize in order to obviously deliver to your citizens. So it's really that we know exists in public resources, and it is also an incentive-based one. So the better you do, the more resources you get allocated. And hopefully those that are obviously part of this program will be able to capitalize on that.
Kaya, it seems as though National Treasury at this point is trying to balance both carrot and stick. I think about the Nelson Mandela Bay municipality that the National Treasury is upset with for not having done enough to address the 22 billion rand in wasteful expenditure that was uncovered there. It seems this program that we're looking at here is more of the carrot side of the conversation rather than the stick. How precarious a balance does this become for National Treasury, especially given that we do have that midterm budget policy statement happening tomorrow?
Well, it's not easy, because at the end of the day, the simple question that each of these particular decision makers has to answer is, if such resources and such loans didn't exist, are you now conceding that those that have been given the responsibility to manage the city simply wouldn't be able to do the job? And that is a problem on its own. So you do need to be able to go back and remember what the binding social contract is between those citizens and those that have been given the responsibility and the power to run and manage those cities. And the expectation is that with what we give you and with the rights and responsibilities we give to you, you will be able to do the type of job that we expect as citizens. And when that doesn't happen, there ought to be some element of accountability. What this seeks to do is that it says, look, the rules of the land and the rules of governance structures, whether it's municipalities or councils, those rules must be able to hold those that have been elected and appointed accountable to what they've signed up for. What this particular model seeks to do is that it seeks to provide a more overarching incentive to do much more than just what you've been contracted to do. So a lot of these particular bureaucrats and some of these councillors will say, well, actually, we've done the minimum that was expected of us. And the question is, if we want these cities to improve and we want these cities to continuously get better, what would we put on the table as a driving positive stimulus? And that's really what this particular conversation is about. And I think obviously National Treasury has a much bigger mandate of balancing the trade-offs across the state at large, and they would struggle to justify simply allocating additional resources to just 8 of these sub-national government structures. We do have 257 municipalities in total, so the idea that you'd prioritize 8 out of 257 will be very difficult to sell, so that you do need to get some partnerships, whether it's through loans or through other means. They've clearly gone for loans right now, which is not always desirable, but you do need to find some complementary access to resources that will enable these cities that carry the bulk of the economic activity to do much better, so that you turn that into a much more positive multiplier effect. The better the cities are, the better their ability to correct rates and tariffs. And in the world where subsidization is the way we do things, the more resources the big cities and the big brothers can collect, the better it is for everyone else, who then depends on getting some of those windfalls to cascade towards them. So it's a much bigger public policy conversation, and we do need to be vigilant, naturally, about how all of these are managed, because ultimately it is still a loan, isn't it?
Kaya, I want to get into exactly that aspect of it. We seem to be, as a country, we seem to be increasing our borrowing rate, particularly from multilateral organizations and offshore borrowings, the likes of the World Bank and the IMF, for various purposes. If I remember correctly, the conversation out of National Treasury was an effort to stabilize our debt to GDP. Can we just understand, perhaps from a balancing act perspective, how achievable this becomes? Because as the debt continues to grow, one would inherently need to see the GDP grow as well.
Again, when it comes to public policy trade-offs, the question is not whether you borrow. The question is the purpose for the borrowings. So in an instance where you are borrowing an additional rand or an additional dollar, the most important question is not just whether you borrowed, but at what rate you borrow and for what purpose that you borrow. So if you are able to take those borrowings and then multiply them onto something much greater, in other words, the social and sometimes even the economic returns exceed what that borrowing is, then you're in a net better off position. So the key issue here is that when you then look at what the rules of engagement are, there should be some clarity that if you borrow this amount of money, we expect you to invest in this type of infrastructure, whether it's social infrastructure or other forms of infrastructure, that then ultimately enables you to deepen or widen your rate payer base if the rates are what you collect, your tax base if the tax are what you collect, or whatever other windfalls you're getting from there. So you do have to be able to acknowledge that the loan is just a starting point. The purpose of the loan is a far more critical question. And obviously, when these are being put together, we anticipate that those that are responsible for putting these deals together and for championing these deals are very alert to the need to ensure that the net social returns, however one measures them, exceeds what the cost of borrowing is. So that really is what you're dealing with here. Unfortunately, because of the legacy of borrowings that have been ill-advised in the past, it does feel like that we are simply just deepening the black hole of borrowings. But it is important to be able to distinguish between what is necessary borrowing that is targeted towards activating that multiplier impact on all of these social dimensions, versus paying for the sins of the past, which is obviously something that, unfortunately, we're stuck with until we honor all of those historical obligations.
South Africa has never had a problem attracting capital into its markets and into its economy. It has always historically been about the use of these funds and finances. One will have to see how this intended loan is then distributed from a South African perspective. But for now, we'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Thank you to founder and director at Kariska Consulting, Kaya Sotole, for joining us to take a look at the latest loan that's been approved from the World Bank for South Africa.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieron Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As of 11 o'clock this morning, the quarterly labor force survey for the third quarter of 2025, released by Stats SA, suggests that the official unemployment rate in South Africa decreased by 1.3 percentage points from 33.2% down to 31.9%. We're going to be taking a look at this and potentially seeing what this means for the South African economy. I'm joined on the line by economist at Momentum Investments, Sanisha Pakirisamy, to see what we make of these numbers. Sanisha, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your initial thoughts around the unemployment figure? I suppose not a lot of people were expecting such a significant move.
Thank you, Jimmy, and good evening to all your listeners. Now, I think in general, we do have very weak jobs growth in South Africa, and we haven't really seen that economic growth has been inclusive as government has promised over the last number of years. And every so often we get a little bit of a blip higher in the jobs growth figures. But I think it's important to note that that unemployment rate that you mentioned earlier, once you include all the people that are what we call discouraged work seekers who have effectively just given up looking for a job, that expanded rate of unemployment remains quite high, north of 45%. And so in that context, we are still struggling with a very high level of joblessness in South Africa, leading to elevated rates of poverty and inequality.
Sanisha, perhaps you can help us kind of get a sense of the numbers. Can we get a sense of, as you said, the truer picture of what's going on? I mean, the discouraged job seekers, that number increased by a significant amount, I think around 36,000 people. Can we get a sense of not just the headline figure, but some of the more granular numbers around these latest jobs numbers?
Sure. So if we look at that increase in the number of jobs on a year-on-year basis, that was up at 109,000 and quarter-on-quarter up about 248,000. Now, year-on-year, I think the biggest contributor there was the financial services category. And if we look at the quarter-on-quarter, there was quite a big uptick that came through for the traded goods sectors and for the government. I think what really concerns me is the number of discouraged workers, which is now sitting very close to 3.5 million people in South Africa. And when you start to really drill down into the various sectors, the one that really holds the most concern is indeed the manufacturing sector. If we think back to the beginning of 2008, you know, manufacturing sector jobs contributed to around 15% of total employment in South Africa. And if we look at the latest data that was now released for the third quarter, the manufacturing sector, you know, now contributes about 9% of total employment in South Africa. And so that shows us how the manufacturing sector and industrial activity has essentially been whittled away since the global financial crisis. We have seen, you know, the jobs growth in the community services, which is largely government jobs, that's been relatively strong, together with financial services, things like the construction sector. And we know, you know, that economic activity has been quite downbeat over the last while. Yeah, we haven't really seen any movement in jobs. You know, if we look across the age distribution, levels of education, I think that there are some more startling numbers there that do give us a bit more insight into the underlying employment picture in South Africa.
Sanisha, when we look at how this then influences the economy, a lot of economic decisions are centered around, especially from a policy perspective, around creating jobs, around being able to have a workforce that is employed or employable. How does this now then shape that conversation? And how do we now start to understand in a bit more detail what is needed for that conversation?
I think a lot of it stems from, you know, the differences that we see across level of educational attainment. So we know that, you know, the less education that you have in South Africa, the less employable you are. But what is also concerning is that even if you have a tertiary sector education, you know, there's still an unemployment level here of almost 11%. And so that, you know, does tie in with a picture that even with a high level of education, our workforce is not really being absorbed into the economy as effectively as it could. We've seen that the youth unemployment rate in South Africa is also quite substantial. For those between the ages of 15 and 24, that unemployment rate is sitting at 58%. And so when we're thinking about policies to address joblessness in South Africa, we have to center it around improving the education system, which we know is a very long-term structural reform. We need to look at how to absorb the youth in South Africa into the labor market. And we also need to address the racial inequalities. So if we look at the black unemployment rate in South Africa at 31.9% versus the white unemployment rate in South Africa of 8%, it does tell us a story of how we still need to create jobs for those in various sectors of the economy. I think what's really worrying at this stage is that once you are unemployed, you know, those that stay unemployed for what we call the long term, so more than a year, that's picked up to 77%. So 77% of the unemployed in South Africa have been unemployed for longer than a year. And that's, you know, is a picture that I think is quite startling for the youth of South Africa, because then it just reduces your chances of becoming employable.
Sanisha, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around how this potentially influences tomorrow's midterm budget policy statement. We know that these are the sorts of numbers that National Treasury does take into consideration when delivering their midterm as well as main budgets. How do we think this could potentially influence tomorrow's conversation, if at all? And how are you feeling ahead of tomorrow's conversation in terms of what we're expecting from Treasury?
Well, you know, I think that this does highlight the big concern that we have in terms of that tug of war between government spending priorities and having to adhere to fiscal prudence. We know that we've got demographic headwinds, deep inequality that push the fiscal demands beyond government's revenue raising capacity. And that is going to force some very difficult trade-offs. Fortunately, you know, coming into this budget, we do expect the revenue numbers to look a little bit better. We have been helped from a commodities perspective, a favorable terms of trade, because gold and platinum prices have done quite well. So mining profitability is contributing to those tax revenues on that side. We've also seen that the expenditure run rate has actually been a little bit softer. And so that could open up a little bit of fiscal room to maneuver. But I think in the medium to long term, you know, there are still some significant weak links in the fiscal chain, such as the state-owned enterprises and governance failures that we've seen there, together with the financial problems at South Africa's municipalities. And this means that those demands on the fiscus are ever growing into the medium to long term.
Certainly some important considerations from an employment and a jobs perspective, and one wonders where these considerations fit into conversations like the midterm budget policy statement. However, for now, we're going to leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the economist at Momentum Investments, Sanisha Pakirisamy, for joining us to take a look at the latest unemployment figures released by Stats SA.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by Nedbank Agribusiness. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. It is Tuesday, and typically on Tuesdays, we do have an agri feature that alternates out with our property feature. We are going to be looking at an agri conversation a little later on, but we're going to do something special and give you a double bill of agri conversations. We're going to be taking a look at agri tech and the technological advancements that have taken place in the world of agriculture and how that's lent itself to improving the lives of the farmers in South Africa. I'm joined on the line by the Senior Manager for Agriculture Client Value Propositions at Nedbank Commercial Banking, Desiree Lissette. To take a look at this and see what you make of it. Desiree, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. If you asked me, I'd say perhaps just before the pandemic, of a concept called agri-tech, I don't even think I would know how to answer that. A couple of years later, post-pandemic, I think tech has taken over a lot of people's lives. How has that spilled over into the agricultural world?
Thanks, Jimmy. That's a great question, and evening again to your listeners. So if you look at the agri-tech side and the agri-tech world, this world has grown so exponentially over the years, and COVID as well has rapid that growth. And if you just look at from global landscape alone, in 2023, this made about 40.2 billion and is projected to double to about 90.1 billion in 2033. And this again, it just looks at how clear and how the agriculture market landscape is shifting fundamentally. But just to answer you to your question, I'm going to look at this in about three phases. First, what is driving this growth is the global push towards efficiency and transparency in agriculture. Farmers are under pressure to produce more with less resources, and the digital platforms are helping them to streamline procurement and improve pricing discovery and as well reduce their cost. In South Africa alone, this shift particularly is important. We see farmers faced with unique challenges, and some of them are coupled with rising of input cost. Looking at the fuel prices, fertilizer prices, and again, coupled with climate changes as well. The e-commerce space, which is the agri-tech space, which is where we come in as Nedbank and play a role into assisting our farmers with partnering with our players in the agri space, is where we're looking to make a change to say, if we can create platforms where farmers can be able to compare prices of input, agriculture inputs such as fertilizers, seeds, and fuel, this alone gives farmers a chance to be able to purchase at a lesser price and reduce the lengthy space of them driving to different areas to compare prices on their loan. So this agri-tech world in the South African landscape brings a lot of efficiency and assisting farmers. And from Nedbank's perspective, we see this as a broader transformation where agriculture is no longer just about the land and labor. It's about the data, the platforms, and the partnership that can drive sustainable growth.
Desiree, you mentioned partnerships and you've alluded to it. I want to look into the Pricewise platform and get a sense of just the thinking behind that and what it does for the agricultural landscape and the agricultural community. We know our farmers battle challenges. Many of them battle the same challenges. And I want to get your thoughts around the partnership aspect of that particular platform, but more than that, what it allows the farming and agricultural space to be able to achieve.
Thanks, Jimmy. So the Pricewise partnership is a perfect and fantastic example on how technology can solve real world challenges in the agriculture space, right? It is an online platform that allows farmers to source agriculture inputs directly from suppliers, compare prices at a real time, and have those products delivered straight to their farm. So it has several benefits, and those benefits are tangible. First benefit, it saves time. Farmers no longer need to spend hours or even days traveling to towns or agri-dealers or agri-co-ops to source inputs. With Pricewise, they can do it all from the comfort of their farm, on their phone, or on their laptop. That's the first benefit. The second benefit, it reduces cost. By allowing farmers to compare the price across multiple suppliers, farmers can make more informed decisions and avoid overpaying. And this is particularly important when you consider the input costs can account to about 60% of the total farming production expenses that farmers experience. The third boost that we can look at as a benefit is this can boost productivity. Timeless access to right inputs, especially during planting and harvesting window for farmers, gives them a good chance to plan in advance. And PraiseVase ensures that farmers are not delayed with the stock or shortages or the logistic backlogs that can happen. So with PraiseVase, they're able to plan on time. And finally, another benefit that brings this, and this is quite important, which links with how we see things at Nedbank and being the green bank, is the sustainability benefit of this. So by reducing the travel time, the platform helps lower the farmers' carbon footprint, which is increasingly important as we move towards a more climate resilience and farming practices in South Africa. So that's just some of the benefits that this can do. But from Nedbank's perspective as well, this is a partnership that we look at just beyond banking. Some of the benefits that we can give to farmers beyond banking, which is the efficiency and the comfort and the confidence that they can use this platforms from the comfort of their home without driving long hours.
Helping farmers grow smarter with the use of technological platforms and advancements in the agricultural space. That is the aim of Nedbank Commercial Banking. And that is where we're going to have to leave this conversation. Thank you so much to Desiree Lesele, the Senior Manager for Agriculture Client Value Propositions at Nedbank Commercial Banking, taking us through Nedbank's partnership with Pricewise and their advancements in agri-tech. This feature was brought to you by Nedbank Agribusiness. Think bigger, think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank.
What if a bank didn't just finance your farm, but helped you grow it? Nedbank Agribusiness offers more than just financial solutions. Our experts provide deep industry insights to help you identify opportunities and risks within your business earlier. Agriculture evolves, and so do we. We stay connected to industry stakeholders and the latest research, ensuring your business thrives on every hectare. So when you think growth, think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank, we're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we're taking a look at the midterm budget policy statement. Of course, this takes place tomorrow. We expect that National Treasury will table that tomorrow. Hopefully, it's a lot smoother than what we have seen through the budget tabling of this year. We don't expect any hiccups at this stage, but we'll keep an eye on that. For now, we'll do a bit of a look ahead to what we can expect tomorrow. I'm joined on the line by economist at Econometrics, Dr. Azar Jamin, to see what we make of this. Dr. Jamin, always lovely catching up with you. I remember very clearly when you and I sat in studio the first time that Democratic South Africa had to cancel its budget speech, and you and I looked at each other. This time around, we're getting a sense of potentially what we can expect tomorrow. I want to get your thoughts around what you think should be top of mind, or what might be top of mind for our minister.
A number of things that will be top of mind. The first one is a determination to convey that, contrary to a lot of expectations that many people have had in recent times, the government is not abandoning fiscal discipline and is actually managing to contain the budget deficit and the public debt to levels lower than people had feared. And in fact, latest evidence suggests that government hasn't spent as much as it said it was going to, and at the same time has been collecting more revenue than anticipated, partly as a result of the surge in precious metals prices and the resultant profits of mining companies. And that means that I think there's a good chance that he'll be able to show the deficit is turning out to be lower than anticipated in when he presented the budget in May. The second thing I think focus will be on whether or not the National Treasury agrees to the Reserve Bank's pressure to reduce the inflation target from a range of 3 to 6% to one of a point blank a point range of 3%. There was originally a lot of apprehension on the part of National Treasury to follow the Reserve Bank downwards with the inflation target. But if one believes an article in the Sunday Times that suggested people in the know say that it has finally agreed to reduce that inflation target, and that both of those things would be quite favorably received, I think, on financial markets. The third big area of focus will be to see what governments' budgets for economic growth themselves are. Is it relatively optimistic? There's been a mood of optimism flowing through markets in recent times that suggests that we are about to gradually lift our growth rate from 1% upwards to 2% or more over the next few years, helped along by Operation Vulindlela and structural reforms. It will be interesting to see what the minister says in that regard.
Dr. Jameen, I want to come back to the point you touched on around the commodities and perhaps look at the windfall there. I think coming out of the COVID pandemic, the super cycle, the somewhat cycle that we had on the commodities rally of 2021 or thereabouts, we saw around 100 billion rand in windfall coming through for SARS and for the economy. Do we expect similar numbers? I mean, this year's rally has pretty much covered the entire year. How big a windfall are we anticipating here?
I think we are expecting a substantial windfall. I think 100 billion rand is possibly excessive to anticipate, but certainly more than enough to plug that gap that was going to be plugged with a 2% VAT hike that you and I remember back in February that caused the budget to be postponed. I think we are looking for a number somewhere between 50 and 100 billion rand.
Dr. Jameen, in terms of the other side of the conversation, I mean, you touched on the fact that economic growth is also going to be a pillar of conversation. We just spoke to Momentum Investments, but this has also been the sentiment around in the market around the fact that the unemployment figures, although showing some signs of positivity, are a long way away from where we would like them to be. Do we think we'll hear anything around this with regards to what is tabled tomorrow?
Certainly, there will be mention of the high unemployment rate and an acknowledgement on the part of the government that it is still high. But I think what the government will try and sell us is the view that the structural reforms that are being attempted under the auspices of Operation Vulindlela will yield positive benefits. I think the key factor to recognize, and it'll be interesting to see whether the minister actually conveys this, don't be too impatient. Some of these structural reforms will take time to actually manifest their success. And in that regard, of course, much depends on the speed with which South Africa can start clamping down on this vicious spiral of corruption and criminal syndicates, etc., that is fortunately being brought to the forefront by the Madlanga Commission and other legal processes right now. The awareness has improved, but will this translate into concrete action that actually puts an end to criminal syndicates that are scuppering many of the attempts at embarking upon infrastructural investment that can enhance service delivery?
Dr. Jameen, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around what we could potentially hear from National Treasury with regards to the grey listing and the outcomes of that. We had anticipated that we would want to be coming off that grey list before the end of 2025. It has happened. We've managed to get that done. A significant milestone for the South African economy, for the South African financial systems as well. Do we anticipate that that will have any positive spillover effects from a budgetary perspective, or at least from a planning perspective, that Treasury might be able to lean into tomorrow?
Well, to a large extent, it has already had some positive spin-offs. I mentioned higher commodity prices, but that's not the only reason why the budget deficit will turn out to be lower than anticipated. The other is that long-term interest rates have fallen by 1.5% in the past 6 months, and that in itself can work towards reducing government expenditure substantially and paving the way for the government to actually adopt a much more have much more positive fiscal parameters that could, judging from rumors, result in an upgrade of our credit rating, which would be most welcome. And then you get into a very virtuous circle of lower interest rates, less government spending, and lower deficits, and therefore not such an increase in public debt. And that compares very favorably with the opposite that is happening in so many countries in the world, including both developed and developing.
Well, we'll see how tomorrow shapes up. We are anticipating this conversation. We have been looking forward to it. We hope that we don't have any unexpected surprises coming out tomorrow. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Dr. Zajamin, economist at Econometrics, for joining us to get his thoughts around budget expectations for tomorrow.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by Nedbank Agribusiness. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. Several weeks ago, we heard an announcement that South Africa's stone fruits had found a new home in the Chinese markets. Just today, we're taking a look at the citrus exports from South Africa's latest season, and it seems as though we've had another bumper export season. For more on this, I'm joined on the line by the chief economist at Agbiz and good friend of ours, Wandile Sithlobo, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Wandile, always lovely catching up with you. Thanks so much for taking the time. It seems as though South African agriculture is finally loving the seasons. It seems as though we're having record numbers coming out. Today we're looking at the citrus market, but I know this is not the only market that's doing well. Let's start with what's been driving such growth.
Jimmy, you are right. We have been powering through excellently since the start of the year. Just thinking about the first and the second quarter, the export activity has been superb in the second quarter, reaching $3.7 billion, up 10% from a year ago. And I think that for the third quarter figures, when we put everything together, we see such optimism. There's two things that have been behind this. One, the ample harvest in the fruit, wine, vegetables, grains, all seeds, and sugarcane production, as well as just the efficiencies at the ports that we see improving. We've had a much smoother export period this year compared to recent years. And of course, reasonably higher commodity prices for some of the products, and all of this delivering these excellent results that we see in our exports data.
Now, Andile, we are still battling some trade friction and some fears in the global community. How is that playing out in the minds of exporters and the agricultural community? I imagine some of these factors are entirely beyond the control of the agricultural community. And so it's just to best navigate them and prepare to deal with the worst, I guess.
You are right on that, Jimmy. And one of those markets is, of course, the United States. And what we saw was that a lot of farmers took advantage of that 90-day pause. And you'll recall that at that period, it was our export season for citrus. Farmers down in citrus-style region of the Western Cape, they managed to harvest with speed, and they pushed a lot of crop in there to an extent that in the second quarter of this year, we saw that our overall agricultural exports to the U.S. were up 26% at just around $161 million. And that, of course, is one of the key contributing factors to the strong citrus exports that we are seeing now for 2025. But beyond that, because now the tariffs are a reality in the U.S. market, and depending on how AGOA will turn out, we may end up with exports of about 33.4% when you add the most favored nations tariff rate. That, of course, assuming that AGOA, we are out of it. But in other markets, we are powering through. And we are looking at exporting and opening up more markets in the Far East while retaining what we have in the EU and other regions of the world.
You touched on the Far East, Wandile, and we spoke about this. I spoke about this in the intro to this particular conversation, saying that we managed to secure some interesting stone fruit deals into China in particular. I want to get a sense of the shifting tides, at least from a BRICS bloc grouping, and how that is playing itself out in the agri space. Has the agricultural community rightly said, as you allude to, around AGOA, if AGOA is to not be brought back to the table, then this might be the next block or the next grouping that could benefit our space?
We like, Jimmy, to view it as growing the export pie for South Africa, meaning that retaining what we have while at the same time adding there. And you are correct, because that is an exciting region. I mean, China alone, they buy over $200 billion worth of agricultural products from the world market. The countries that the South African leadership recently visited, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, if you look at how much they buy from the world market, each of those countries spend over $20 billion buying a whole range of agricultural products. The key reason South Africa has had minimal participation in them is, one, reasonably higher import tariffs, and two, the phytosanitary barriers, because we're dealing with biological products here that needed to be ironed up. And I think that at the political level, the conversation is open, but now the real work, which should be led by the DTIC, the Department of Agriculture, and our friends at DERCO, needs to continue so that we know that those markets are truly open and this diversification doesn't just remain at a conversation level, but businesses get to see the benefit of that. And that will require then that trade technical discussion continuing in all of this market.
Wandile, so I then suppose that from an agricultural standpoint, from a farming standpoint, the farmers can concentrate on the one area that South African agriculture excels in on a global stage, and that is quality. Because when we then supposedly get to the point of these agreements being finalized, it's even easier to get them over the line if we simply showcase to the world the quality of citrus that we have, the quality of grapes that we have, and everything else that we export.
Absolutely, Jimmy. And I think over the years, we have been able to showcase that to an extent that if you look at South Africa today, although we are a semi-arid country, we remain the only African country in the top 40 global agricultural exporters at number 34. And of course, we continue to improve in those numbers. And yes, we don't want to only be the African country that is there. We want our neighbors and many others to expand also and get into production so that these regional value chains are strong. But from a South Africa standpoint, I think the key things for the farmers to remain on the quality side, focus on that, while the Department of Agriculture, DTIC, DERCO, assist in opening up as many export markets as they can. And I think even the regional partnerships with some of our neighbors in the African continent in terms of learning, exchanging knowledge, so that all of these exports and the region begins to play an important role in global food exports continue. So that's the general thinking. And I think those are things we aim to be doing. And Jimmy, this last one of the region, which is why I'm highlighting, you know that in a week or two time, we will be focusing on the G20 aspect. And in there is a focus on the agricultural task force. And the key things, amongst other aspects that I discussed, is exactly that, on how do we boost agriculture in Africa while at the same time enhancing trade and spreading more learnings about which region is successful and what is it doing excellently. And South Africa is at that position to share learnings with the region, Africa, as well as the other parts of the world.
Well, from an African continent perspective, we have $3.7 billion worth of reasons to share our expertise in the agricultural exporting space. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to the chief economist at AgBiz, Wandile Sithole, for joining us to take a look at the agricultural exports for the second quarter of the year in South Africa and what that means for our markets. This feature was brought to you by Nedbank Agribusiness. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank.
What if a bank didn't just finance your farm, but helped you grow it? Nedbank Agribusiness offers more than just financial solutions. Our experts provide deep industry insights to help you identify opportunities and risks within your business area. Agriculture evolves, and so do we. We stay connected to industry stakeholders and the latest research, ensuring your business thrives on every hectare. So when you think growth, think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. Cooper, licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the show for today, folks. If you've missed the conversations, you can catch up on them as podcasts, of course. We will be bringing you all of the budget coverage as we always do tomorrow. There won't be an afternoon show per se, but we will, of course, have our usual show this time tomorrow evening, taking a look at everything that was said by the minister, or that will be said by the minister tomorrow. For now, it's coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. So from my side, good night.